This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
The joy I have in introducing Dallas Willard is I think you need to understand it through a half a moment of biography of my own. As a very young man going to Westmont College, I was looking forward to hearing a professor from University of Southern California come and speak. I had been a Christian nearly all my life, but going to a progressive high school in the 60s, I had formed the opinion from my teachers that I would be a second-class citizen since I was a Christian and couldn't break free of that crutch that I needed. And so I felt a sense of death in me, and I read the works of Francis Schaeffer and C.S. Lewis in my high school and early college years and was beginning to be, in a sense, born again to real strength in the Lord, because I was realizing there are people who have a voice and who have an understanding, and they're Christians, and that was exciting to me to discover that. Then I went to Westmont and found out that there were actually some of those people who were living and breathing, and you could talk to them, and that was delightful. And then as I was a young philosophy major at Westmont, and we had the extraordinary privilege of a professor from the University of Southern California come to speak. And I do remember that night, I won't tell you how many years ago, that I sat on the floor of one of the classrooms because the place was jammed to hear Dallas Willard come and deliver a paper on, I believe it was the ontological argument for God's existence, Dallas. And so from that day, and that was about three decades ago, from that day, Dallas Willard has been one of the mentors, even though he hasn't known that, he's been one of the mentors in my life just because of his presence and his force in the world of ideas. Now, you may be wondering, since those of you who know Dallas, you know that he's not 90 years old, nor anywhere close to that, so how is it possible that I could have been an undergraduate and Dallas a professor at USC coming to speak at Westmont? I would just say this, it was early in his career there, and I am prematurely gray, okay? So, but if you're in a suggestible mood, I would just say that I'm a lot more handsome than you might think, so. We are truly blessed to have Dallas with us. Dallas has a couple of bachelor's degrees in philosophy and psychology. He holds a doctorate from the University of Wisconsin in philosophy and with a minor in the history of science. He is a specialist in metaphysics, epistemology, philosophy of logic, and several other things, writing technical philosophical publications in these areas. But most of us as Christians know him for the wonderful books that he's written in spiritual discipleship and spiritual formation, culminating in the last several years with his wonderful book, The Divine Conspiracy, which was an award-winning book with Christianity Today, and just recently the release of his book, Renovation of the Heart, Putting on the Character of Christ. I haven't read the book yet. I understand that it is a wonderful theology of the human person, the psychology, and how spirituality weaves in with the nature of the human soul. And so this is wonderful to have a walkthrough in these areas. Dallas is an ordained pastor in the Southern Baptist Convention, but he's also a pastor at USC. Our pianist and music director, David Clemenson, was a graduate student at University of Southern California, and he told me the story that when he was going through graduate school, he knew another graduate student who was a bass player, the bass violin. The man had developed a disease in his hand, and was finding it difficult to pursue his art and his dream, and it was troubling his soul. And he and David talked several times about this, and finally this man said, I guess I've got to go see Dallas. And David asked, Dallas who? Who's this? Oh, he's a philosophy professor here, and he talks to Christians and everybody about Christ. And so this man took David, and David sat outside the office while Dallas counseled with this bass player for about an hour and prayed with him and helped him see the way forward. So we have a real man of God who is a pastor of souls, Dallas Willard.
Thank you, Gain. After introductions like that, you're afraid to say anything, you're afraid you ruin your reputation. But I'm very grateful, and it's wonderful to know that Gain is walking over there beside me at a little distance, but I'm always conscious that he's there and thankful for him. He truly is a man who has put his life on the line for education and for what that means as a Christian. I'm just thankful for you again, and God bless you. And good to see you again, David. Glad to be reminded of that story, and now you must tell me afterwards how our friend went on from there. Well, I'm supposed to talk about the Trinity this morning, and my first thought is, where is our singer, Ken Miedema, when we need him? I thought after he got done with Roberta and then Wormwood last night, the Trinity would be the next step. And we need his help, I think. So we'll just have to miss him. But we're going to be talking now about the last book of Mere Christianity. And everyone who has spoken has said something about the impact of Lewis on them. And I will be very simple, because it is very simple. When I was in undergraduate school at Tennessee Temple College in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and rooming with my brother in the dorm, he walked in one day with a copy of Mere Christianity, this old copy here. And so I began reading it, and the simple thing that came to me was, this is just right. It was the tone more than the content that struck me. Here is a fellow that is standing squarely on his 2 feet, not trying to poo-poo or avoid difficulties, who just simply stands up and addresses the issues as one man among men. I later discovered a phrase from an old English philosopher by the name of L.T. Hobhouse that characterized it so well. And then I realized that Lewis had been raised in the atmosphere. And that phrase from L.T. Hobhouse was, all that religion calls for from thought is a free field and no quarter given. And that's exactly right. A free field and no quarter given. And then it's hit me with your best shot. Right? That's it. And that was the great gift of Lewis to me, was I knew that there was no need to duck anything, that I didn't need to pretend. And later on, I formulated that in ways that made some of my Christian friends uneasy, but made me easy. And that was that if you could find a better way than the Christian way, Jesus would be the first person to tell you to take it. You see, he's not ducking, he's not hiding. And if you can't believe that about him, you're going to have a hard time trusting him. And so trust came to mean that to me. And it made me very comfortable then wherever I was, because I knew that Jesus would be comfortable there too. If he were at the APA meetings, I think some other people would be uncomfortable, but He wouldn't. All right, well, you know, it's remarkable how much the human race is interested in getting beyond personality. Understanding by personality the ordinary sort of person. And the perhaps most common manifestation of that is in the obsession with death that you see now, and cryonics and all of that. And in the Los Angeles Times this morning, we have, "It's a wrap for all eternity. A Utahan says he has convinced 1,400 people to become mummies in the afterlife." How many would you like to be a mummy in the afterlife? Do you have any volunteers? Well, actually, you see, it says he's still waiting for his first customer to die. But you know all this stuff about cryonics, trying to transcend. Another dimension of that is our superheroes, Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk. You know, it's just one thing after another. And all of that is about getting beyond personality. That's what the Harry Potter thing is about. See, it's about getting beyond personality, isn't it? See, it's transcending, getting over on the other side of something. And, you know, I've heard a number of people get in a real lather about Harry Potter. Don't worry about it. Harry Potter is not a stayer. After Harry Potter has been forgotten about, Narnia will still be read. And here's the reason why. See, there's a reason for it. And the reason is there's no deep magic in Harry Potter. It's all superficial. It's tricks. There's no deep magic. There's no Aslan. It's all Shadowland. And it's tricks for individuals to play out and get power. Narnia is a different story. But you see, it's all transcendence, the hunger for transcendence, the need to get a buzz on from alcohol or drugs or sex or whatever. That's the trying to escape, to get beyond personality. One of the deep parts of mere Christianity. And by the way, isn't it a relief to know that there is a mere Christianity? Isn't that a relief? Isn't it a great sigh? Whew, I'm glad. There is a mere Christianity. And you don't have to haul all of those historical accretions that make so many of us look so weird. You don't have to haul that along, you know. Yeah, if you want to dress that way, that's fine. That's not Christianity. That's something else, and if you like it, that's good. If you want to say these funny things, that's fine. Yeah, you know, you were raised in it, you love it, and you love those who were raised in it with it, that's okay. But that's not mere Christianity. It's what Paul calls vessel. The treasure is mere Christianity. And one of the great things in mere Christianity is the affirmation that there is a beyond, that wherever you're stuck, there is a beyond, and the beyond that your heart is crying and your mind is crying out for is really there. Maybe not as you understand it at present, but it really is there, and God has made it available. Actually, the beyond begins in Lewis, in Mere Christianity, in the previous book. If you look at the last paragraph in the previous book, you'll see wonderful statement here. It just blows your mind. This is on page 116 of my version. I don't know if it's the same with yours. He says, "I think all Christians would agree with me if I said that though Christianity seems at first to be all about morality, all about duties and rules and guilt and virtue, yet it leads you on out of all of that to something beyond." Now, Lewis is a great writer, and of course, he's setting up his next section, Something Beyond. But listen to what it's like. And really, this gives you the clue as to what it's like to be beyond personality, and not be sort of just stuck down in your little old world there with your little old body and everything that has become you, and you're isolated and you're... Now, listen to this. One has a glimpse of a country where they do not talk about those things, about duties and morality and so on, except perhaps as a joke. Now, that's probably why that person said to Roberta, don't read that book. Everyone there is filled full with what we call goodness, as a mirror is filled with light. But they don't call it goodness. They don't call it anything. They're not thinking about it. They're too busy looking at the source from which it comes. But he says, this is near the stage where the road passes over the rim of the world. Beautiful phrase. I'm going to come back to that at the end because I'm going to read to you the last two paragraphs of the last battle, because that's the final beyond. But that's what he's talking about here, you see. Imagine personality that doesn't have to talk about duties, goodness, and all those sorts of things. You see, the something beyond is a kind of life. It is a kind of fulfillment in life beyond this life. And it is so beautifully presented in the concluding passages of Narnia, and I will have to come back to that later. But let's just understand that when we use the phrase beyond personality now, we mean beyond what we ordinarily take to be persons. But remember, that's shadowland. That's shadowland. And so when we see ordinary persons in our world, we're looking not at the reality, but at the shadow. And now there's one mark that characterizes the personality which we go beyond. One mark. And that is separation. Separation. So if you would just write that word down, because that's what the whole discussion is about. Beyond personality is about getting beyond individual existence as we know it. Now, we have to be careful with that because, as you know, the key to God's plan, or as Screwtape says, the enemy's plan, is his ignoble plan, is to have his cake and eat it. The eating of the cake isn't going to get rid of it. That's the way it is in Shadowland. Individuality can be preserved in a higher life. And now we've seen that this morning, the three wonderful myself that Paul read, Jan's passage about being partakers of the divine nature. That's moving beyond separation. And that is where Lewis is going to take us. And now, you know, we're not really in his context. There's a real sense in which Lewis could presuppose a lot of understanding and acceptance and start right off talking about the Trinity that we can't presuppose today. Lewis understood, I think, prophetically what was going to happen in the university world. But the version of naturalism that we have to deal with today is much more serious than the kind he had to deal with. If I had times in a scholarly way, I could take you into that and show you what naturalism was in the years that he was writing this book. If some of you are hungering to do that, there's a book by a man named Kerkorian called Naturalism and the Human Spirit. And you'll see that it's a very different. See, what we're dealing with today is a system that is predicated upon the idea that the only reality is physical. That the only reality is physical. And we have to do our quest for knowledge in that context. See, the human problem can be stated as how to find an adequate basis in knowledge for life. How can you find an adequate basis in knowledge for life? And that's the human problem. See, if you have a closed society, then there's an elite group of people who are in charge of this knowledge, and your task as an individual is to conform to it and follow what they say. I don't advocate those kinds of societies. An open society is one which says, well, there are people who know stuff, but they could be wrong, and they don't know everything. And we are teetering between an open and closed society in the intellectual world. And we have a certain group of people, I'm not saying they are bad intended, it's just this is the way it's developed, who want to be in charge of knowledge. Right? And they want to say that knowledge derives from the physical sciences. And so that is why, for example, we have all this big discussion about DNA and things like that and brains and so on. Now, you see, that there's a problem with that because if that's all you knew, you wouldn't be able to get out of the building. So you try that. You consult your physics and chemistry and biology and try to get out of the building. I mean, I don't have time to go at length in this, but I need to call attention to it, you see. Now, the university traditionally has assumed basically what Lewis calls mere Christianity, or something close to that. Let's say a genuinely spiritual view of reality and the human self. We can't presuppose that anymore. So where Lewis could jump right into the Trinity, we have to think a little more deeply about what's involved here. So let's start with this, spiritual reality, because that's where the first battle is fought. I want to say a few words about it, and then we'll go on to the other two topics, which is the Trinity, and then the new life in the individual. And that is beyond personality, as we understand it. So we have to think about spiritual reality. And the assumption today is that there is none. There is none in the universe, and there is none in the human being. Yeah. Now, that is predicated on a very simple project, and that is human mastery of the universe and life. You know that game, that video game, Masters of the Universe? Deeply theological. Deeply theological. That is the human project. Now, if you say spirit, then you're dealing with something that you can't think in terms of mastering, at least in terms of human knowledge as we've come to understand it. That's why there is such a rejection when someone wants to talk about evil. So one of the primary giveaways as to the situation of the intellect today is it cannot deal with evil. And ask yourself, now, why is that? Why is it on the campuses especially you can't take evil seriously? It's very simple. To admit evil is to admit something that is beyond human control. And so that is why when some public official or someone wants to talk about evil in a serious way, see, evil has been banished from ethical theory. Of course, it's been banished, good has been banished too, but they go together. And so instead of thinking in terms of good and evil, we back down to what Lewis mentioned earlier, rules, duties, obligations, things of that sort. And we try to capture those, perhaps in something like a applied or professional ethics, but it doesn't touch the heart. See, the real professional ethic is, how may I use my profession to be a good person? Or an evil person. That's where the real ethical questions about the profession arises. And you can never deal with goodness and evil in human life, but that's a spiritual matter. It's a matter of the spirit. So let me just go over a few terms here. I'm sorry to lecture at you like this, but I feel I almost have to do it to just touch what Lewis is dealing with. What is spirit? Let me give you a shot. And, you know, you don't have to believe all this. Actually, I've been wrong about a few things in my life. But try this on. What is spirit? Spirit is unbodily personal power. It's unbodily personal power. See? That is to say, it doesn't derive its nature or existence from the body. It may interact with the body, may even inhabit a body, but that's not where it's from. And then secondly, it is personal. That is to say, it is made up of thoughts and feelings and choices and decisions. None of that, the force be with you stuff. See, what characterizes Christian spirituality over against New Age spirituality is the insistence that the spiritual is not for our use. What characterizes every other spirituality that you will find running in our culture is that it is for your use if you can just figure out how to do it. Just watch Oprah and you'll see it coming. But everything from Satanism to Gary Zukav, it's the same thing. You find this thing. See, that's the form idolatry always takes. Christian spirituality is there is a God who is not for our use. And that's where Lewis comes in. And if you're worried about that, you need to be worried about it. Okay, because I want to say once again that the entire weight of the world of knowledge as we know it is against the existence of a spiritual reality. And even many people within religion attack it in terms of what they call dualism. But see, God, a creator God, is essentially dualistic in relationship to creation. God doesn't even have a brain. Did you know that? We'll say it again. God doesn't have a brain. And apparently he doesn't miss it. I mean, he existed before there was anything you can make brains on. And brains are important parts of a body. I mean, they're a relatively interesting piece of meat. And in my present condition, I wouldn't want to be caught without one. But for God, everything is a no-brainer. That's why that, see, that's, now, and he's perfect, see, let me put it another way because this is so important. The only form of energy in the universe is not what you find in matter. Bodies are a form of potential energy, but they're not the only form. For example, you did not come here today by the laws of physics. You used them, but if the laws of physics had been all that was in operation, you wouldn't be here unless you were blown in like a leaf blown in by the wind. See, ideas, thoughts, choices, that's spirit. That's reality. Energy is whatever does work. Ideas do work. Choices do work. Now, you see, the story is that a chimpanzee has 97-some percent. Actually, they found one now. I think last report was 99.4% of your DNA. Now, what conclusion am I supposed to draw about me? What is the conclusion? The conclusion is I'm very like a chimp. Isn't that the one? Right? So perhaps we should give them the vote. Where's Tom? Tom Keyes. That wonderful thing about democracy last night. I mean, let's be democratic about it, right? Now, you go to the person who made this research and found that a chimpanzee, there's a certain kind of chimpanzee, has 99.4% of my DNA, of his DNA. And you ask that person, do you believe that the chimp has 99.4% of your experience? Catch him in a thoughtful moment where he can absorb the question. And then you say again, now do you believe that chimp there has 99.4% of your experience? What do you think he'll say? Well, you don't take it home and think with you. Think about it. But I'll tell you, if he has any sobriety about him at all, he will not say that the chimp has 99.4% of his experience. You see, when you hear that, you don't draw the conclusion, I hope, that you're very like a chimp. Here's the conclusion you should draw. There's a lot more to you than your DNA. That's the conclusion you draw. And there's a lot more to you than your brain. And that's why the chimp doesn't have 99.4% of your experience. Because if they had 99.4% of my experience, they could make better grades than a lot of my students do. Now, quickly moving on, you see, Lewis recognizes that there is a spirituality to the universe and there's a spirituality to the human being. And now he's going to help us think about that. And so when he comes into beyond personality, there are two questions that he deals with. And one is, how can there be a Trinity? I'm so thankful he doesn't come onto that defensively. You know, I'm going to prove to you that there's a Trinity. See, Lewis knows that what hinders confidence in mere Christianity is not so much argument against it as the inability to imagine it. It's the inability to imagine how it could be. Not is there a Trinity. What would it be like for there to be a Trinity? And so Lewis gives us a whole series of statements in the book, very helpful, imaginative. And, of course, this is an old project. St. Augustine and others have tried these to give us images of what it's like for there to be one thing so caught up in other things that it becomes something new and yet remains the same. See, that's the problem. He tells us a little story, if you remember in there too, as well. Consider a line. You get one dimension in space. You can just move back and forth on that line. Now, construct a plane. Okay, now you can move in various directions, but you can't go this way until you add some more lines. And then you've got a cube, and then you've gone three-dimensional, right? Now, what happened to the first line? Well, it's still there. But it has an entirely different role. Hasn't lost its identity. It's been caught up in something else, and now it contributes in ways that you would never have imagined if you just looked at a line, if all you knew about it was that it's a line. You wouldn't know what would happen if you combined it with another line and another line and so on. And so the genuine creativity of unity that he illustrates gives us a sense of what it's like to be one person and yet part of a group in a way that you wouldn't be what you are if you were not a part of that group. And the group wouldn't be what it is, and yet you retain your individuality. See, that's personality now beyond the shadow land. The Shadowland is atomistic and says things like, how can three be one? Now, you know, actually a lot of theologians never get out of Shadowland. For example, they're never able to tell the difference between identity and unity. And they think rather dumb things, like everything that is distinct is separable. Right? Our friend Mr. Hume, drawing from deeper sources, David Hume elevated that to an ultimate metaphysical principle. Well, you're dead. You don't have to go to the Trinity to get dead on that one. Because not everything that is different is separable. There are many things that cannot be separated from other things. For example, you can't separate regretting from remembering. But they're not the same, are they? Because you can remember without regretting. Not everything that is distinct is separable. And Lewis comes on with these wonderful statements about the Trinity. I wish I had time to read more, but I do want to read just one. This is on page 136 of my edition. If you have yours, I hope you will turn to it. Here's what he says. And that, by the way, is perhaps the most important difference between Christianity and all other religions, that in Christianity, God is not a static thing. Now, he is certainly including Judaism in this when he says it, because God certainly is, as one rabbi has said, God is not the unmoved mover, but the most moved mover. In Christianity, God is not a static thing, not even a person, but a dynamic, pulsating activity. A life, almost a kind of drama, almost, if you will not think me irreverent, a kind of dance. The union between the Father and the Son is such a concrete thing that this union itself is also a person. Now, of course, if you're back in Shadowland, you say, that can't be. Right? But we're not in Shadowland. We're moving beyond it. And now we know that it could be a person. And Lewis's beautiful illustrations. See, he comes at it from experience. He doesn't come at it from on high. He talks about how when you remember, he talks about how you kneel down in your room to pray. You're praying to the Father. And the Son is standing beside you. And the Holy Spirit is moving within you. Now, don't go at that from some abstract notion. Go at it from the experience. One of the things that Lewis is most helpful to us on, and it's already been discussed very helpfully, is the fact and the theory. And over, Christians get hung up on the theory, and they wind up creating something that has nothing to do with mere Christianity. Lewis is talking about the fact of how do we experience God? How do we experience God? Page 137, he goes on this theme, talking about how personality develops and then how we are to be brought into the dance. And if you want the whole story, really, I mean, this passage from the chapter on the good infection gives you both the story about the Trinity and the story about the individual who's taking on the new lie. He says, all of us are called to enter that pattern, take his place in that dance. Now, if you're worried about that, remember to reread John 17 when we're out of here, and reread the first chapter of 2 Peter, which Jan read from. Each one of us has got to enter that pattern, take his place in the dance. There's no other way to the happiness for which we're made. Good things, as well as bad, you know, are caught by a kind of infection. If you want to get warm, you must stand near the fire. If you want to be wet, you must get into the water. If you want joy, power, peace, eternal life, you must get close to it, or even into it, or even into the thing that has them. They're not a sort of prize that God gives out. They are a great fountain of energy and beauty spurting up at the very center of reality. I'm going to read that again. They are a great fountain of energy and beauty spurting up at the very center of reality. If you are close to it, the spray will wet you. If you're not, you will remain dry. Once a man is united to God, how could he not live forever? Once a man is separated from God, what can he do but wither and die? You see. Remember, the key is separation and union. Separation and union. And so God in himself, as the old Puritan said, is a sweet society. At the center of the universe is not a black hole. It's a wonderful dance that's going on. The people say to me, what was God doing before he created the world? He was enjoying themselves. Right? That's what he was doing. And he didn't create out of need, he created out of fullness. And pouring forth from this great, infinite community is an unstoppable procession of creativity. And that's the invitation to us. That's the invitation to us, is join that. See, God not only creates, he creates creators. And that's you. And that's you. See? And he invites us to step into that life and that flow and to become a part of it. And in the process of redemption, we need to catch that life, and we catch it not only from the ultimate source in Jesus Christ, who came into the world and joined himself to humanity and stood as one among other human beings. We catch it from others, and we encourage it in one another's. And the union that is in the church is to reflect the union that is in the Trinity. And it's unfortunate that often what we mean by church are a few hours of well-calibrated distance. See, that's not God's idea of the church. Fellowship isn't necessarily what happens in fellowship hall. And we need to look deeply into this process, that God has set a foot through his Son, actually before his Son. Because you see, the great Abrahamic covenant that comes blasting out of the Old Testament and through the new into the modern world is a covenant that we are still moving in. God said to Abraham, in you and in your seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Yeah. And the wonderful things that come out of that stream of life, you see, the Trinitarian presence on earth. And God sent his Son, and his Son sent us. And his Son said to us, I've been given say over everything in heaven and earth. Go, make students in London, in the theater community, Chapel Hill, business world. See, you have a wonderful quotation on your program about this, the opening page, I think, where it talks about how that was intended. See, that's the call upon us to join that community, to step into the stream of life, to know the power of God that is moving, and to understand the reality of love as a triune structure where I love you and you love me and we love them. See? Love is always threefold. It's Trinitarian. Love is Trinitarian. Love is never completed without three. And when we live in that circle with the one who said, all power is given to me in heaven and earth, go ye therefore to the businesses, to the universities, to the art world. See, we go in that power and we believe that God is with us. He said, I'm with you every moment till the job is finished. Right? And take the Trinitarian reality and we began to easily step into the things that Jesus said to do. And I want to conclude just on that note, because you see, the human problem is how do you do it? I love the statement in Lewis about be ye perfect, and how be ye perfect is not idealistic gas. Wonderful statement. It's not idealistic gas. It's on page 160 in this edition. I should have checked to see if your edition is the same. The command, be ye perfect, is not idealistic gas, nor is it a command to do the impossible. He is going to make us creatures that can obey the command. He said in the Bible that we are gods. Now, how are you feeling this morning? He said in the Bible, we were gods, and he's going to make good on his word. If we let him, for we can prevent him if we choose, he will make the feeblest and filthy of us into a god or goddess, a dazzling, radiant, immortal creature, pulsating all through with such energy and joy and wisdom as love and love as we cannot now imagine. A bright, stainless mirror which reflects back to God perfectly, though of course on a smaller scale, his own boundless power and delight and goodness. This process will be long and in parts very painful, but that is what we're in for. Nothing less. He meant what he said. Now, he's going to let us off the hook by saying it won't happen in this life. I'm not sure that's off the hook. You know, because actually the easy way to live is this way. The hard way to live is in Shadowland. The easy way to live is walking in the teachings and character of Jesus. That means living in the creativity of Jesus. Devoting oneself to the good. Living for it. And being pulled out of the incredibly dreary smallness that curses our personal relationships in our families, in our work, in our national relationships. Being pulled out of that, that's the torturous way to live. Lewis talks about that, and you know, one of the chapters in the last book is about whether or not is it hard or easy. And of course, living in the way of Jesus is hard if you're unchanged. But if your toy soldier has been making progress towards becoming a real little person, it gets easier and easier, so that the hard thing to do would be to do what you used to do. See, I mean, when Jesus hung on the cross and said, Father, forgive them, that wasn't hard. What would have been hard for Jesus? Well, to rip off a few curses and say, just wait till my Father gets a hold of you. See, why would that have been hard? It would have been hard because it would have been totally out of character. See, when our toy soldier, our tin soldier, has made some progress, it isn't difficult to be gracious and loving and powerful, as much power as we can stand. It's waiting on our character. You know, I like to say that God's intention for each of us is that we should become the kind of person that he could empower to do what we want. That's what he's waiting on. I didn't make a mistake about that last pronoun. What we want. That's what he's waiting on. That's a character issue. See, the tin soldier is becoming a little Christ. Now, the last movement beyond. This is the end of the last battle. The last chapter, you remember, is titled Farewell to Shadowlands. And you remember the story there. Finally, things are coming together. And Peter and Edmund and Lucy now see their own father and mother waving back across a deep valley, and they're coming together. And puzzled, the donkey is looking a little down. And the lion bowed down his head and whispered something to Puzzle, at which his long ears went down. And then he said something else, at which his ears perked up. The humans couldn't hear what he had said either time. And then Aslan turned to them and said, "You don't yet look so happy as I mean you to be." And Lucy said, "Well, we're so afraid of being sent away, Aslan, and you have sent us back into our own world so often." "No fear of that," said Aslan. "Haven't you guessed?" And their hearts leaped and wild hope rose within them. And Aslan said, "There was a real accident. Your father and mother and all of you were, well, as you used to call it in Shadowlands, dead. The term is over, and the holidays have begun. The dream is ended. This is the morning." And as he spoke, he no longer looked to them like a lion. But the things that began to happen after that were so great and beautiful that I cannot write them. And for all of us who are still here in Shadowland, this is the end of all the stories, and we can most truly say that they all lived happily ever afterwards. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story, all their life in this world, and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now, at last, they were beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, and in which every chapter is better than the one before. Amen. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. And now questions and answers. At least questions. And if you'll help us by just coming to the mics that are being set around, that way the questions can get on tape. If you ask me, I will just burst from the chute and start answering it and won't repeat the question. If I have something to say, probably if I don't have anything to say. But if you would come to the mics with your questions, or either that or shout very loudly. Yes. Richard.
Okay. I think in one case, you know, I disagreed with you.
Okay.
You're saying that there's mere Christianity and then the rest is icing, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that's true. What Lewis said is mere Christianity is the hall, and lots of rooms lead out of the hall. And the worst of the rooms, no matter which it is better than living in the hall. So, you know, mere Christianity is what
all
real Christians or true Christians believe, but there's more to it than that, and it's not just icing.
The mere Christian isn't just icing? The other stuff isn't just icing. Right. Yes. No, actually, you can't live in the hall. And so if I do try to develop this further in the last chapter of Renovation of the Heart, but you cannot not have a vessel. You can't just have treasure. And that is part of our finitude, and it's actually a beautiful thing. And that's why we should treasure those rooms. I was raised a Baptist, and I guess I still am. I don't know how you get over that. But and I'm thankful for it. But I discovered at a certain point that it was more important for me to be a good Baptist than a good Christian. And then I said, something's wrong. Right? So, no, I cherish that, and I believe we should cherish our vessels and love them. And we love the people that we were raised among and that have been a part of the journey. Sometimes you'll see that even in people who have been caught up in what are called cults, is that they love the people who are in those. And you see, I think that we should respect that and love that. So thank you, Richard. I don't think we disagree, but that's an important clarification.
I didn't think we did.
Yeah, and it's so important. Yeah. Oh, it's so important to know that you can't not have a vessel. Praise God for the vessel. Just don't worship it.
For now, one more question, and then we'll take other questions from the panel.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
One more question at this point, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions during the panel following the intermission. One more question.
She was there. Janice?
I have a short story to say about you just before I ask the question, though. I don't think you know this. I was at a philosophy conference in which you were a speaker, and the previous speaker had just finished. And I was sitting next to a friend of mine, and she said, you know, I agree with almost everything he said, she said about the previous speaker, but there's just something about him. So I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I wouldn't let him babysit my kids. So then you spoke. You came up after that and you spoke. And I said, well, what do you think? She said, I'd drive my kids to the next county.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Dennis. Thank you.
But here's the question. I'm advisor to a Muslim student group at
yes.
the college where I teach. And it occurred to me in your presentation this morning that Trinitarian monotheism is... on the sandwich between, at least historically, a simple monotheism, Judaism, and then a later
yes.
simple monotheism. And can we make any philosophical or theological hay of that?
It's very slow work, and it has to respect the person who comes from those backgrounds. But here is what I would do. I would try to engage in a discussion about their experience of God. And I would say now things like, you don't want to say that God is just an ordinary person. I mean, how do you think about God is the point we begin. And I think you have to have great sympathy with that and not just sort of start out from what you might regard as an orthodox doctrine, as the creed says, neither confounding the persons nor dividing the substance and so on. I think the abstract categories are the thing that causes us the great, great problem. I believe that Lewis is really right to present the Trinity as emerging out of experience. And that's where I think we can make contact with people. God is, I think, on any of these three traditions that we often call the great monotheistic traditions, I think on any of those accounts, he is overflowing the cup of individual personality as we know it. And so then the problem is simply to find out how do you catch the overflow. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.